All right. Thanks for tuning in. You are listening to Gaucho Amigos. I'm Alex. Today, my guest is Steve Kahn. Yes, the wonderfully gifted jazz guitarist who has a huge body of work. He's played with many legends over the years and was nominated for several Grammys, including one for his collaboration with a former guest of this show, Rob Mouncey. That album is called Local Color, and it's great. You should definitely go check that out. His solo albums, Arrows and The Blue Man, both feature a number of the same musicians that played on Steely Dan albums, including Rick Murata, David Sanborn, Don Grolnick, and Steve Gadd. And for the purposes of this podcast, Steve was one of the most significant contributors to the album Gaucho. He is credited on 5 of the 7 tracks. He played the guitar solos on Glamour Profession and My Rival, and as much as anyone, his guitar tone kind of defines the sound of the album. And since he's on it so much and spent so much time collaborating with Donald and Walter, you know, he was someone I was eager to interview for this podcast. I believe last summer I reached out to him for an interview, you know, right around the same time I asked Rob Mouncey to come on. And Steve wrote back a really nice reply, but he said he didn't want to do it. You know, no problem. Completely understood. You know, several months went by, and then about a month or so ago, I saw that Steve had put up a full band recording of one of those Lost Gaucho songs. I Can't Write Home About You. Maybe some of you saw that. Steve put that up along with the lead sheet. And I had never heard that complete version of the song, you know, with a full band behind it. And I was thrilled to hear it. You know, I know other Steely Dan fans were excited as well. And so I thought, you know, what the hell? Maybe I'll shoot Steve another message to see if he would come and guest on the podcast. And sure enough, to my surprise and delight this time around, Steve was game. And we talked. And it was great. So here you go. Without further ado, this is my conversation with the great guitarist, Steve Kahn. Enjoy.
When I got called to do Asia, which happened because of Elliot Shiner, I didn't know anything about him. I mean, I know that Don Grolnick had played on some records before that one. Rick Murata had, Purdy had. So I knew that, but beyond that, nothing.
So you knew that some of the other musicians who played on Asia and eventually Gaucho, you had, you know, you knew who they were and you knew their work, and maybe you had even played with them at times. Is that correct?
Well, all the guys in New York, played with them a lot.
Right.
And there isn't really much, what word would I choose here? Like cross blending between the coasts, you know, having any of the West Coast guys come here to New York to play with us, at least, you know, not on those sessions, not on the one tune I played on Asia. I mean, the closest we got to any of it is I remember some of the, you know, piano scores that we were all playing from. A couple of them said arranged by Larry Carlton. So that's about as close as we got, you know, to Los Angeles.
So Donald and Walter first called you in to play on Asia on Peck. Had they heard your work before?
Yeah, I really don't know. The thing that made it so uncomfortable, especially working on Peg, was that they barely said 2 words to me the whole time. And I remember at one point, and I did know by then that they're famous for erasing people. So I walked in assuming, now I'll do the best I can and expect to be erased. And so at one point, when there was a quiet moment, I came behind Elliot Shiner's chair and I whispered in his ear, I said, Am I doing okay here? Or is this okay? And he goes, no, it's great. They love it, you know. And I said, oh, I said, they're not saying anything to me. He says, don't worry, everything's fine. And that was the sort of the beginning of learning that they really weren't concerned about anything other than getting a drum track that was usable. So it's not that they don't want anybody to screw up, and they certainly don't want somebody playing something that's derailing the process of getting a great drum performance. So if someone's doing something that's distracting from that, you probably get told, don't do that. But I mean, the parts were so, it was so, not for guitar, but the keyboard parts were so clear. I don't remember, I remember them talking to Chuck a lot about, what he was going to play, et cetera. And of course, they were talking to Rick Murata a lot. And I think, we had been told that they tried this tune in Los Angeles with a bunch of different rhythm sections and, never for some reason got it.
So you said Donald and Walter barely said two words to you? Like they, what did they say? Do you remember? Did they give you any
No,
instructions?
they said nothing. Honest to God, they said
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, I guess barely said two words to me is a euphemism. That they never, I don't think they ever spoke to me, other than maybe we said hi, and at the end we said, good night, thanks. That was it. And maybe I saw Elliot Shiner a few weeks later. I said, well, did I get a raise? He says, no, they love it. It's still there. And it's really funny, the result of what I played on that. A lot of people over the years, this is now what, 45 something years ago, people think I invented that little muted style of guitar playing. And it's really funny. It was going around here in New York, for ages. All the guys here, knew how to do it, et cetera. And I remember at one point, long before that, asking somebody like, where did that come from? And everybody used to say to me, like, Jerry Friedman kind of invented that. And I worked with Jerry a lot, and Jerry was a top session guitarist here, songwriter, many things, and beloved by everybody. And the story was, Jerry would say, they said, well, how'd you come up with that? And he says, well, there was another guitar player on the session, and he was doing something, chords and rhythms and stuff. And I said, I just ran out of shit to do, and so I just did that. And he said, people liked it. So it's kind of funny how that came into being, but playing on this, sort of big hit Peg, people, for years were saying to me, oh, that's, amazing you, invented that. I didn't know. I didn't at all.
So
Not me.
that's amazing. Yeah. And so Donald Walter didn't say anything to you before. They pretty much said nothing to you after, right? You walked out of the sessions. You didn't know if it went
You know,
okay. Like how did, yeah.
maybe they said one thing to me.
Okay.
When the thing was done, they said, can you do something in the intro? And so, because I had already played the piano and the Rhodes were sustaining the chords, and you have this. So I played all that stuff. And I don't know what they were. So I said, well, okay, let me try this. And so I had this gray MXR flanger sitting on the floor there. And I just turned the regeneration up all the way. And I mean, I never thought they were going to like that. So it goes, meow, meow. And that's what that sound
There's
is.
that subtle sound in the intro that is a little flanged sound.
Man, I don't know if it's subtle, but it's and they liked it.
Yeah.
So I mean, that was just really funny to me that something that was so ridiculous. Of all things, they liked it, and it, you know, it stayed with the song.
Now I have to ask, did you ever take a shot at doing the solo that Jay Graydon ended up playing? Were you one of the like many guys that
lucky for me, I was never asked. So,
So you did your own part on Peg, you know, you played your, you made your contributions, but then when it came time to, you know, find that guitar solo that they were searching for so vigorously, that you weren't part of that whole process at all.
No, never. I was never asked. And again, I'm really glad I didn't go through that.
Yeah. So, you know, what did you think when the song and the album took off? What was your response?
Well, you know, it was all kind of interesting to me because I had no idea what the rest of the record was. So to hear all these songs that have become, you know, pretty much all of them are like classic amongst people. And some people, like in your interview with Rob Mounsey, I mean, Rob thinks that's the greatest record. You know, there are a lot of things I really did love about it. I mean, you know, one of the things that I took away from my work with them, you know, was how beautiful, from an audio perspective, things sounded in the studio. You know, when Roger or Elliot would, you know, push up the faders, I mean, it sounded like a record already. It sounded really, really fantastic. And back then, their monitor speakers, I'd never seen them before, were a pair of Visonic Davids. They're German speakers. And I don't know if you can see behind me, but maybe I'll turn up. Do you see the speakers there?
Yeah.
Those are the same Visonics that I bought because of Steely Dan. And I have an extra pair that I used to, that I, if I was still making records, I take to the studio and use for mixing so that I can hear, you know, a perspective that makes sense to me, an audio perspective. And I think working with them, you know, gave me a perspective on fine audio, you know, what beautiful audio sounds like, and that it can be applied to anything. I mean, there are people who think that, you know, Asia sounds very cold and sterile. I know a lot of audio people who think that. I never really felt that, but
me neither.
You know, that working with them on that changed my audio life. And the saddest thing is that here we are, 2024, nobody has a stereo. Nobody has, you know, a good, powerful amplifier. Nobody has CD players. You know, some people have these goofy little stupid turntables that 14-year-old girls in the 50s used to have. And they think they're listening to, you know, they're listening to vinyl like it's some revelation. But that isn't what vinyl was supposed to be either. So it's just crazy. I mean, and there are some of us, like me and other artists too, who are killing themselves to try to make beautiful pieces of audio, and nobody's ever going to hear it that way. You know, listening on earbuds and headphones, that's not what the artist intended.
Yeah, I mean, there are some people who still kind of carry that culture of, you know, being an audiophile or like a hi-fi person, but it's not as prominent as it was at the time that Asia and Gaucho came out, for sure. And I know that, like, for example, Neil Young, you know, he, I think, created his own, you know, MP3 player because he was so dissatisfied with the quality of his music on, you know, on iPods and Spotify and these things. So there's a small faction of people who are kind of carrying the flame into the 21st century, but certainly, like, in terms of, you know, comparing now to the time of Asia, there's no comparison. Like, there was much more emphasis put on, you know, having a good amp or having, you know, high quality audio, et cetera.
I mean, you can't stop what has happened. I mean, this is where we are. And like I said, you know, when you labor like a lunatic to try to do your best to make a beautiful, obviously the music is the number one thing, but you also want to make, a beautiful piece of audio, if we can call it that. And, long ago, most of us realized, like, well, we'd all laugh about it through mixing, through mastering, like, nobody's ever going to hear it this way. And it's really hard to, let go of the hope that somebody, one person is going to hear it the way you hear it. But for the most part, it's never going to happen. And there's aspects that, listen, I probably couldn't on two hands name 10 musicians who I know personally who have a real stereo. That's how fucking pathetic it is. I'm dead serious.
Yeah. So you're kind of disillusioned with the whole state of how people are hearing these records, whether they're contemporary or from the past.
Yes, I find it to be very sad.
Drive west on Sunset to the sea. Turn that jungle music down just until we're out of town. This is no one night stand, it's a real occasion. Close your eyes and you'll be there. It's everything they say, the end of a perfect day. Distant lights from across the bay.
Babylon Sister, shake it.
They felt, meaning Donald, Walter, and Gary, that I was somebody they could work with. And again, some of the people, like a Hugh McCracken, was somebody they loved and trusted. It's just Huey, works slower. And so, like, sometimes it's best to bring in Huey as an overdub, where he has all the time in the world to, like, what he crafted on Hey 19 is just brilliant. And that's totally 100% Huey. Nobody plays like that. A beautiful touch on the instrument. So, I was somebody who was good for all for some reason for all of those songs, and I played on all of them, whether I made it to the end is another thing. Like
well, you ended up on 5 of the 7,
right? And
more than anyone
and I
else
but I but I played on the other ones too.
You did.
So
yeah.
I mean, I played on Hey 19.
I mean, it's
but
close.
But got erased. And
you and Rob Mouncey are as close to kind of permanent Gaucho band members as there were. You guys played on a whole bunch of the tracks, especially you.
Yes.
I mean,
yeah. And I think, and Don Grolnick was there for a lot of it too. So, what you call it? I was going to say I played on Time Out of Mind too, but got erased. Okay. So. And then there are the famous 4 songs that never got finished.
We'll get to that.
And I played on all those too.
Yeah, definitely want to talk about that. So what was the vibe like there? Was it different than on Asia? I mean, do you remember what the feel in the studio was?
Well, because we were all together so much, I wouldn't say there was a vibe and doing Peg. If there was, I was oblivious to it because I was just trying to do a musical job that, I just wanted to play something that was usable. I just, serve the song, do what you think is right for the song, which is kind of my, guiding signpost no matter what I'm doing. But Gaucho was much more intense because, there were going to be So, you know, I remember, although Gary, I guess, kind of disputes it, but I did, you know, a series of days with Rick Marotta, a series of days with Jeff Porcaro, a series of days with Bernard Purdy. And I think I even did a couple of days or a day with Chris Parker, too. And so, you know, it was a lot of being together. And sometimes, like, I remember, you know, playing some of the same songs.
So were they
With
using
different.
you as part of the band to get that drum track, like you were saying, and that's why you kept working with all these different guys? So were you playing like, Glamour Profession, and they were using one drummer, and then you were playing, Glamour Profession again with
Well,
another
Glamour
drummer?
Profession was, like I said, was later. That
Okay.
was an overdub.
That's right.
There was never, as I remember, you know, a Glamour Profession session,
Or how
but
about
there were
Babylon
sessions.
Sisters? Babylon Sisters.
That was an amazing experience because. It's the only time I ever saw this happen. I think, you know, obviously we ran it down. And again, you know, as I said before, everything is a piano score. So, for someone like me, you can see, what the voicing is in the right hand. You see what the top note is. You know, you can hear what Donald's singing. So you want to play something that's doing one of two things, that's marking those top notes in the chord voicings, or that's apart from that and is a more something more rhythmic, almost the guitar as a percussion instrument. So there are a number of ways you can go, but everything is right there in front of you, and you have to, you know, try and craft something that works for the song. And so, you know, doing that, you know what, Purdy is an amazing person and drummer. He's just, you know, one of a kind drummer and person. And so when I heard him playing that halftime shuffle thing, I went, oh my God. Yeah. Because he's worked with Bernard a lot. He doesn't give up his, you know, grade A shit unless he knows it's worth it. You know, I'm not saying he ever phones anything in, but when he unleashes something that's so uniquely him, you know you're in the middle of something special. Because I could feel that right away. And what happened was, this is my recollection of it.
Okay.
I think we did two takes, and you know, it was winter time, and I remember Purdy puts on his raincoat or his overcoat. He walks into the control room. Everybody's listening back and kind of blissing out on how great it is. And it's a very complex song. There's a
Yeah.
lot going on. And Bernard walks in and he says, "Well, fellas, that's it." And he left.
That
And it
was it.
was
He did his
fantastic.
two takes and then he was done for the day.
He knew it. I mean, he just said, "It's not going to be any better than this." And I don't think they would accept that from anybody.
So you think Donald and Walter deferred to Purdy because of his kind of legendary status and his unique drumming style, which is kind of hard to replicate. Maybe
Well,
under
I
normal circumstances, they would have done a whole bunch of takes, but because it was Bernard, they're like, okay, we got it.
think they also knew it. You know, you just, I mean, look at it, I could say sometimes you just know, but as part of the rhythm section that did all these things, there's any number of takes that Rick Marotta did, or that Jeff Porcaro did, or other songs that Purdy did. If it was my album, I would have been jumping up and down and would have said, okay, that's it. You know, they made us do, you know, sometimes tons of takes. My relationship with their music, I'm often called in, you know, the very last moment. At that moment, Glamour Profession was almost going to finish the record because I don't think Third World Man had been done yet. And eventually I got called in for that. And Donald, I remember him saying to me, like, this is it. You're the last thing that's going on this record. So let's get this done. But that was Third World Man. But Glamour Profession, I remember at one point, there's a little break in the middle where there's this, like, it's a guitar choir. Where it goes, bum, 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 bum. It's just before the piano solo.
Right.
And I remember Donald, he said to me, "Can you play that?" He said, "It's four-part harmony." He says, "I'm supposed to sing that." He says, "But I don't have the energy for it." So I said, "Sure." So, you know, I wrote out the four parts.
So that part was going to be a vocal part.
Yes.
Wow. And okay, I didn't know that.
But it could have been just oohs and ahs or something.
Right, but still,
I don't think
Yeah.
But it's very much, you know, the way Donald, you know, was capable of doing those kind of things.
Totally.
You know, I played them one at a time, and then they, you know, made a blend of the four parts, and there was that. And you know, when it came to all the soloing stuff, you know, I just played, and so, of course, I did the first take we did of the whole thing. I really liked it. You know, it sounded like this is right for the song. And then, of course, they started to, you know, do another one. And then they started to like, well, this is great. Let's just go in for some little pieces that we hear that we'd like to be a little different. And so we started, like, you know, punching in little things here and there. And, you know, what are you going to do? I just did what they asked me to do. So that was that stuff.
What did you think of the songs themselves, you know, kind of the lyrical universe or just, you know, the construction? Because they're pretty complex, right? I mean, for pop songs.
No, they're great. I mean, I think what I've often said to people is, like, when you work that hard on a real album, like, you know, a bunch of songs, in your crazy way, you could become very attached to the songs. You feel like, almost like it's my song. I know that song. You know the lyrics, you know the whole thing. And so whoever the guys are who are there, whether it's Rick or Jeff or Purdy or, you know, Rob or Don or Chuck, you know, Anthony Jackson, whoever it happened to be, you know, you just fall in love with the songs. You really have a love affair with them. And as I said, the four songs that never got finished, it's really heartbreaking, some of them, because, you know, you want to see how they're going to turn out.
And yeah, were you surprised that a bunch of the songs that you, you know, played on didn't end up on the album?
Very much. I mean, there were things, first of all four of those songs, I would say that the least of which was Second Arrangement. But to me, Coolie Baba and this other song called Heartbreak Souvenir, which I've never heard since I walked out of the studio, but
nobody
I knew
has. Nobody's heard it.
But I knew that what Purdy played was so unbelievable that, you know, and I remember.
You're killing me. Because I want to hear it so badly.
I remember this is a true story. The album is sort of coming to an end, and Donald, he's really at a crossroads. He doesn't know. You know, he's saying, like, we need another song. And in that, this is before they went back and dredged up Third World Man, which was originally with a track, Were You Blind That Day, from the Asia Sessions.
Right. Yeah.
And he wrote new lyrics, and there was that.
Yeah. And you can hear, actually hear Were You Blind That Day now. The demos have leaked out.
Yeah. So I told him, I said, listen, and again, this is like, I had the confidence to just say what I thought, because, like I said, it wasn't going to matter to me if I ever got called again or not. I was exhausted from this stuff. So I said, listen, you may not want to listen to me, I said, but you should go back and listen to Heartbreak Souvenir, I said, because you have some Purdy on there that is so classic that you're not going to believe it. You may have forgotten about it, but I said, I didn't. That is just unbelievably great. So he says, okay, I will. He goes back and he calls me like, I don't know, a few days later, a week later. And he says to me, you're absolutely right. It's fantastic. And then he said to me, but it's too hard to sing. And wow. That was the end of it. That was the last.
So Donald never recorded a vocal for it, or did he?
Been a scratch vocal. I'm sure he always usually, you know, used to sing with us when we were playing.
Wow. So what did the song sound like? I mean, was it a ballad? Was it up tempo? Do you remember?
No, I wouldn't say up tempo, but kind of medium tempo thing.
Any memory of what it sounded like?
No, I just know that it was great.
Got it. Yeah,
and I know that it was Purdy, Anthony, me. I think it was Don.
Yeah. Because do you know about this thing called the Lost Gaucho? Have you heard about this?
I mean, I see those things, but I don't really pay any attention to them.
So basically what happened is, you know, for obsessives like myself, there's this thing called the Lost Gaucho, where over the years, demos of these songs that never made it onto the album have kind of leaked out. And they're at different stages. Some of them are just piano bass. Some of them are the whole band. You know, it just depends. Some of them are instrumentals. But they've sort of leaked out over there. So we've gotten to hear, you know, we don't know what stage of completion they're in, you know, these songs like Coolie Baba and The Bear and, you know, I Can't Write Home About You. But the one song that no one has ever heard anything from is Heartbreak Souvenir. So that's the one that's sort of like, it's still, you know, at the bottom of the ocean. No one's heard a thing.
Yeah, I wish I could say, you know, I heard something, but I didn't. I mean, when we left the studio, all I had was, you know, my memory of what had happened. The version that's out there, you know, almost finished, sort of Coolie Baba is great.
Oh yeah, it's terrific.
Yeah, and that I know is me. I know it's Don. I think it's Jeff, and probably Chuck.
Yeah,
because what's kind of unfinished is there are a couple sections where Chuck almost doesn't play the bass. It's like he still was searching for what it was going to be. But the feel of it is really great.
Yeah.
You know, again, very sad that didn't get finished.
Yeah, I wonder why they didn't finish it. And I think basically what happened, I think if they had done another Steely Dan record, I think that one would have made it. I do, because it's you know, because sometimes they would do a song, right? And they would get close, but they felt like it wasn't finished. And then three albums later, it would show up. You know, even up through the Royal Scam, they were doing songs that they had written, you know, pre Can't Buy a Thrill. Like Caves of Altamira was written in the 60s, I think. And then it ended up on Royal Scam, which came out in 76. So I think that one would have made it. But yeah, Coolie Baba is terrific. What about this song that, you know, you just posted, if you don't mind talking about that? I Can't Write Home About You. Because that one I had never heard, or I'd only heard the piano bass version. So it's the first time hearing that one with the band.
Well, you know, it's becoming a funnier story by the minute. I mean, I had never heard that one either since leaving the studio. And, you know, I had resigned myself to, well, that's gone. I mean, the only thing I remember about it was, you know, sitting there at one point and saying to Donald, so what's this song about? And he says to me, it's about a guy whose girlfriend is a prostitute, and he can't tell his friends or his family about her.
That's like what half their songs are about.
Yeah. So that was that, you know, yeah. it was great, you know, to know that. But what happens is what often happens with me is that some goofy fan, he sent me that MP3, which is obviously a cassette copy of a copy of a copy. Who knows how many generations it is. You know, it's really terrible. But when I finally heard it, you know, because he just wrote to me, he said, I just want to know if that's you. And I listened to it and I went, suddenly everything came back to me. And I remember doing that. And, you know, it was me. And then I went back and I checked with Rick and he says, it's him. Rob Mounsey thinks it's him. And it's obviously Chuck. So it's really funny in the intro, and I remember, you know, after listening to it, what I played was a little quote, sort of a paraphrase of a quote from Steve Cropper, something he played on Wilson Pickett's Don't Fight It in the intro. It doesn't sound exactly like that, but that's where I got the idea for that little thing that's there. It cracks me up now when I hear it. I think, wow, it's still there. But it's great, you know, and I remember thinking it was a great song when we did it. You know, and again, it was just really sad that, you know, it's never going to see the light of day.
Rich girls bring their money downtown to hear those cat house blues. Thin men with $1.380 worth of nothing to lose. Tonight I'll find myself in their song. Then I know that I belong. My whole world is here. I'll make
fans pass these tracks around, you know, and when there's a new version, like there was this whole thing with the second arrangement. I don't know if you followed any of that saga, but Roger Nichols' daughter posted, you know, a more completed
yes.
version, right?
No, I, and the amazing thing about that is
yeah.
I had been told a long time ago, you know, that I had been erased from that and that Hiram Bullock was playing on that. And I know that's probably him doing the,
that main riff is him, right?
Yeah, that's Hiram.
Yeah.
But when I listen to it now, the rhythm part sounds like what I played.
Yeah.
So I think I am still in there.
So you're on that version at least, yeah.
I think so. Well, like I said, I know I played on it.
Right.
So, but that was really shocking to me. But that was really funny. I was in touch with Simpsy, and you know, she sent me all those goofy Polaroids that Roger took, and I made a collage that's up at my website that's really funny of, is it 12 of them? I can't remember, but I had a lot of fun screwing around with them.
Yeah, I mean, there's all this stuff about the Gaucho sessions being, like, really difficult, but then you see that Polaroid of you guys, you're all kind of being goofy. It kind of lightens everything up a little
bit. I don't
bit.
Even remember doing that.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a long time, so. But yeah, the fans were super stoked to hear that second arrangement because people thought it was, you know, lost, or the only thing that we'd ever hear from it was just those really cruddy kind of cassette copies. So,
well, there's, you know, whether any of us, you know, were ever going to hear any of it, I doubt it. But, you know, these are things that get out there because some, unfortunately, you know, unscrupulous assistant engineer, after everybody had gone home, probably ran a cassette for themselves, you know, with Rogers or Elliot's mix sitting up on the board. And so as not to lose it, they made one for themselves and, you know, sneaked it out of the studio. And that's where these things come from, because, you know, there's no way, none of us, I've never heard of a Steely Dan musician going home with a cassette of anything. Never.
Yeah,
not
that's what
that,
Bill Schnee said, that that's what happened. He didn't say that he took him, but he said other engineers probably did, other people who worked on it.
Well, not engineers, assistants.
Assistant
Not,
engineer, sorry.
Elliot.
Elliot would drive.
Elliot may have taken, Roger, they may have taken something home, but they would never, ever. You just don't do that. It's completely unethical. I never walked out of a studio with a, the sheet music. Never even asked for it because I just felt like, it's not my place to do that. Which is why I kind of ended up making the lead sheet of "I Can't Write Home About You" just for fun. I just wanted to see what it looked like.
But where'd you get that copy of the song? Is that what the fan sent, or is that from your
Yeah,
own?
it's what a fan sent it to me.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, because I personally, I keep tabs on this. I had never heard that one before. Not the version that you posted on your website. I had only heard that more stripped. I hadn't heard the band, so that's really cool. Thank you for sharing. And somewhat selfishly, I'm glad those assistant engineers made those copies because now I got to hear these lost songs.
And I said, "Gary, he said to me, he said, I'm the one that blackballed that tune." He said, that's the reason they went to
Were you blind
Third
that
World
day?
Man."
Yeah. Interesting.
And I felt like saying, "You fucking asshole."
Well, there was almost an album's worth of songs that got left on the cutting room floor. I mean, Gaucho too, you could put together with some of the Asia and Gaucho outtakes. There's enough quality in terms of the songwriting that an album of those, outtakes would be better than 99.9% of other, artists, work. So but
Yeah,
hey,
if I guess if
you put
seven songs
the
can be
Bear, the
enough.
second arrangement, I Can't Write Home About You, Coolie Baba, Talking About My Home was another one. There's a couple others in there, so
Just to sort of finish the circle here,
yeah, sure.
when they called me in to play on Third World Man, and again, I told you before, they told me, he said, "This is it. You're the last thing that's going on this record." And so they played it for me, and it was so fantastic hearing it, especially what Larry did. It was just, I said, "What the fuck are you, what am I supposed to do? I mean, how do you make something, that's fantastic better?" And they said, "Well, we hear some things." So, I listened, and I was the one that came up with the idea of putting acoustic guitar in there
I love that.
to add a texture
Yeah.
that I thought would be helpful, at least, but they wanted me, I think he Donald used the expression, beef up what Larry had played. And I didn't understand that. Not talking about the soloing stuff, the stuff in the body of the song. The hardest thing about it was, and I'm not making some kind of snarky criticism of anything Larry
Yeah.
did, because I think he's, the perfect guitar player for their music. But for some reason, it took me a while to figure it out, but like his G string is a little out of tune, which makes, I can't tell you how hard that makes it to try and blend in to what's there that's not going to change, and do something that's usable. So I had to find a tuning of my G string that wouldn't be so out of tune that I, wouldn't even want to play it, but that would make sense with that. So I had to do that. And then I remember I felt the most useful thing I did, I put in some power chords, which I think do sound really good in there. But I remember when they told me, he says, "Yeah, this is, from Asia sessions, but that we never finished it." And I just thought it was really great. Very emotional too. I remember Donald telling me he had to call some Italian friend to get that little line that's in Italian. Something like "There's
Del
a
Mondo or
mondo."
whatever, El Teresa del Mondo or something.
Terza, it's got to be third world, you know.
Oh yeah, duh.
So I remember he was really proud of that. You know, but again, it was the last thing. And the funny thing is, that was my role on what you call it? Well, to me, one of the greatest albums ever made, The Nightfly. The little thing I played and the goodbye look was the last thing played on that record. And I sat there and went like, why am I always the last thing to be doing this stuff? And
yeah,
again,
maybe.
it sounded so unbelievable to me. When I heard the finished record, I just went, you know, I still feel that way. This is one of the greatest records ever made.
Oh yeah, I love The Nightfly. I mean, I think Gaucho is just as good, but yeah, The Nightfly is fantastic. So that's all you did with The Nightfly, but you did some of these other Donald songs that weren't necessarily on an album, right? You did The Finer Things and True Companion. Yeah. Tell me about that.
The Finer Things, that was really great. I mean, again, it's probably a song Donald didn't want to sing, or you know, he gave it to Sanborn to be a part of the soundtrack to what the hell was it?
King of Comedy.
With Robert De Niro. And so, but I remember we actually, you know, again, we played live, and I remember what was so great about it is Ed Green was there. And I just loved playing with Ed Green. You know, again, you don't often get that chance to play with these guys from LA who are, you know, to me are all fantastic players, you know, really, you know, and Ed has that big, what I just always describe as the big beat, you know, big foot, big snare. It's great, really great. So I remember doing, you know, again, you fall in love with the song. It's just, you know, kind of plays itself. It's just, so that was great. You know, and I was happy to be a part of it. And what you call it, True Companion, that was another interesting thing where, you know, Donald called and, you know, it was going to be obviously a band I felt very close to with Steve Jordan, who was, we had a band together, Eyewitness. We were playing together all the time. And then it was one of the rare things where Will Lee was playing and Don Grolnick again. And, it was interesting because I remember before that session, Donald, somewhere along the way, had told me as a friend, he says, you know, you really should have a Les Paul. You would be so great with that. And I remember buying one. And that's what I played on True Companion, and along with my acoustic too. So it's just funny that he's the one that encouraging me to get that.
And then did you stick with the Les Paul from thereafter?
No, it's just, I mean, I had it around.
You added it to the rotation?
Yeah, if there was something that I felt it was the right guitar for, I played it. But I played it on that. And again, it was, you know, really a lot of fun. And Donald wanted me to do a lot of stuff on it. Again, it was for this, you know, for some film. And it's funny because there, all the vocal work he did, beautiful, you know, four-part harmony, maybe more. It reminds me of what he didn't want to put the energy into for that little four-bar passage in Glamour Professional.